You are listening to Writers on Writing, and we're on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guests are Carolyn Parkhurst and Jodi Picco. First up is Carolyn Parkhurst, author of The Dogs of Babel. Carolyn holds an MFA in fiction from American University. She has published fiction in the North American Review, Minnesota Review, Hawaii Review, and the Crescent Review. She lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband and their son, Henry. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. I love this book.
Oh, thank you so much.
I just love this book. You've been hearing this so much. You're probably used to it.
I don't think you ever get used to it.
Yeah, it pulled me right in, and I really didn't want to put it down until I was through with it. Will you tell our listeners about The Dogs of Babel, or do you pronounce
sure.
it Babel?
I believe it's The Dogs of Babel, but I think in England they say Babel, so
okay.
Who knows. It's the story of a man named Paul Iverson, who's a linguistics professor whose wife has died rather mysteriously, and the only witness to their death is their dog Lorelei, and in his grief and desperation it occurs to Paul that if he could teach Lorelei to talk, then he might have all the answers he's looking for. And taking on this crazy project to try to teach the dog to talk, he looks back on his whole relationship with his wife Lexi and their courtship and their marriage.
How did you even come up with this premise? I find it so unique, really.
Yeah, you know, I don't entirely know how I came up with it, but I think anyone who's ever lived with a dog has looked at the dog and said, you know, what is going on in his head? You know, he's watching me move through my days, and what does he think of all this? And I think that was part of it, certainly. I kind of started from the characters, and I kind of wanted to write about grief because it's such a universal human emotion, and, you know, we're all scared of losing the people we love, and I wanted to look at the way that this character might get through that process and come out on the other side.
Yeah. Now, how did you choose the profession of linguist for Paul?
Well, I wanted him to be an academic because he's very intellectual and cerebral and, you know, very kind of single-minded in his pursuit of knowledge. And I thought that, you know, if he's a linguist, he's interested in words, it might be less of a crazy leap than if he's like a professor of history or geography or something.
Yeah. Did you have to do a lot of research actually have him be a linguist and have it be authentic?
Well, you know, I didn't actually do that much research on linguistics, and maybe someday some linguist is going to say, oh, you got it all wrong, you know. But I did do a lot of research on dogs and what their physical and emotional capabilities are. And the character Lexi is a mask maker. I did research on making masks. You know, there were various things that I did do research on, but linguistics wasn't really one of them.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
Sure. I would like to read a passage that describes the first time, or I guess second time, but the first time that Paul really meets Lorelei, who is the dog.
Okay.
The first time I met Lorelei, apart from the wary once-over we gave each other the day of the yard sale, was when I arrived to pick up Lexi for our first date, a date that, as it turned out, would last a full week. As soon as I rang the bell, I could hear the enormous noise of Lorelei's bark beginning at some distant corner of the house, and moving with alarming speed toward the other side of the door. I took an involuntary step backward and cowered against one of the porch posts as Lexi opened the door. Lorelei bounded out and leaped toward me, landing with her paws just below my shoulders. I stood rigid as she peered up into my face for a long moment, no longer barking, and I felt an unexpected calm run through me as I met her eyes. For one strange moment, my anxieties about the evening ahead of me faded, and without even thinking about it, I reached out and rested my hand gently on her head. This is the beginning of our story, mine and Lorelei's, a story separate in many ways from the one Lexi and I would begin to create that night. For the first time, I looked into those earnest eyes and touched that rough, soft fur. For the first time, I felt a hint of tenderness for this dog who has, through time and the earthly miracle of canine trust, come to be my own. All that we are together now, the sum of our grief and our play, the daily movement of man and dog through an empty house, following the passage of sun from room to room until it's gone. All of it began that moment on the porch with Lexi standing in the background.
Hmm. How nice. This is wonderful. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Today I'm talking with Carolyn Parkhurst, author of The Dogs of Babel, published by Little Brown. And I must say, as I always do, that the cover is quite nice as well. I always appreciate beautiful covers.
I really, you know, at first I wasn't sure. I thought maybe it should have a dog on it, and it doesn't. It has a mask. But I think it's really beautiful colors, and I'm really happy with it.
It really is.
Yeah.
What sort of input did you have on the cover? Or did you?
I had some level of approval. You know,
uh-huh.
They sent me one design, which we ended up not going with. It just didn't seem right somehow. And then, you know, they showed me this one, and I ended up liking it. So I didn't really have any creative control over it, but I did get to look at the designs as they were making the choice.
Yes. The male point of view, the book is written in Paul's point of view.
Right.
Talk about that, picking...
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, for me, part of the fun of writing is being able to get inside the head of anyone you want, you know. And so for me, it wasn't so much I'm writing from the point of view of a man, as it was I'm writing from the point of view of this man who's 44 years old and is a linguistics professor and is a widower. And, you know, it was fun to me to get inside that character's head. You know, I've written stories in the past that, like, take place in different eras of history, for example, and I find it harder to get inside the head of, like, a... you know, 17th century woman than like a contemporary man, you know.
Yes.
So,
what were the challenges in writing from a male point of view?
Well, I guess I just wanted to make sure I didn't get it wrong in some, you know, fundamental way where people were going to read this and say, I absolutely don't believe it. But I think that, you know, if you write with confidence and sort of try to open yourself up to the character, you know, you generally do okay.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is Carolyn Parkhurst, author of The Dogs of Babel, published by Little Brown. The writing is so clean, and I wonder about the revisions you put mm-hmm. the book through, and whether you're just so fortunate to have your work come out so clean, or whether you worked this book and
well, thank you, but you know, there was a fair amount of revision. I would say I really didn't know what to expect from the revision process because I'd never really worked with an editor in this particular way before. But it was really nice to have someone reading my work so closely. You know, she went through and created this timeline. She said, okay, if their first date is on a Saturday, then 3 years later she can't die on a Wednesday if this is the date. You know, she had all these things she figured out that I had never thought about while writing, and so there were a lot of little things like that. But, you know, I really think that the editorial process helped me make it a better book because I sort of went back and, you know, did clean everything up and kind of just tried to make everything sound the way I wanted it to.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take? How long did it take from, say, first draft to... sending it to the editor?
It was about 2.5 years. I finished it literally the day before my son was born. That worked as a really good deadline to
uh-huh.
me. And, then I didn't do anything with it for, you know, about 3 months because I had a new baby. And
yes.
Then I found an agent, and he sent the book out and sold it fairly quickly. And from that point on, it was about just over a year until the book actually came out.
Hmm. Talk about finding an agent. And was it pretty easy for you with this? I would imagine it was.
Well, you know, it wasn't that easy. I started by sending out query letters to maybe 6 people, and I just got a lot of form letters back saying, you know, oh, we don't think there's a market for your book at this particular time or something like that. And, you know, it's very frustrating because you say you haven't even read it, you know. But I actually had a friend who worked in publishing at the time, and she gave me a list of agents she had worked with that she liked, and I did use her name in my letter to the man who became my agent, and I think that that helped just kind of as an in. You know, I think that, you know, certainly he wouldn't have signed me if he didn't like the book after mm-hmm. that, but, you know, I think that that was certainly helpful.
Now, did any of the agents who rejected it say anything in their letters that later, say, your agent said he loved, or your editor loved?
Really, none of the others had read it, you know.
Uh-huh.
I never got to that point. All of the others either just sent letters back saying, you know, I don't even have time to read it, or they just didn't respond at all. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's the lovely part of publishing.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a real element of luck to it, you know, just getting your work read, you know, getting it on the desk of someone who's actually going to sit down and read it, because they can't judge it until they've read it, you know.
Sure. And then working with your editor, did
mm-hmm.
it, again, were you pretty much on the same page from the beginning, or did your editor ever say, you know, this is what you really have to deal with, and you really didn't want
to? There were there were a few things we disagreed on. There's a fairly major plot point toward the end of the book, which I don't really want to reveal in case, you know, listeners haven't read the book. But we did go back and forth over whether it was the right choice. And I just had to, in the end, go with my own instincts and say, this feels right to me. And, you know, she said, fine, you have the final say on that, you know.
Right. I wanted to ask you as well about one of your skills, actually, that seems to stream throughout the book, and that is that you're really good at compressing action.
Mm-hmm.
And the one place I marked it is further on in the book. To be specific, it's page 166, where Paul, without saying too much, he's looking for Lorelai, and he goes from, you know, having to go to looking at the map to finding the place, and it all takes place in a very short, you know, in a paragraph, I think.
Right, right.
Will you talk about compression of action and just, you know, if this is even something you have ever considered, or if you can say anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
Was this
I've never thought about it in those terms, but I think that what comes through in a book is what the author does and doesn't have patience for. And for me, like, getting from one place to the next is kind of boring to me. You know, I don't say I walked into the room, I slowly crossed the room. You know, I kind of like to get those little details just done and over with in as short a space as possible, I think. And, you know, getting the characters into the scene is what interests me, not the, you know, how they got there and stuff like that. So I guess that that probably comes through in the book.
Yeah, it does. And so when you're writing those kind of scenes, do you go through what you just said? Okay, he walks into the room, he does this, and then you go, you know, I really have to shorten this.
Yeah, kind of mentally. I'm not sure I even write it down, but I sort of say, okay, you know, what's the actual movement in this scene that I have to get across, you know? You know, they're going to have dinner, but I don't need to show them setting the table or whatever, you know. I just, you kind of sometimes assume that you're reader is going to fill in some of the blanks for you, but you know, I guess once you have it in your own head what you need to get across in the scene, then it kind of becomes clearer what you can cut out.
Mm-hmm. The title, The Dogs of Babel, talk about that. Was it all
It was at first just a working title. I wasn't even sure I was going to keep it, but I like it because the story of the Tower of Babel, which isn't even mentioned in the book, but it's a story of people, it's a biblical story of people trying to build a tower up to heaven, and God punishes them by making them all speak different languages so they can't understand each other. And I liked that, I liked it as kind of an emblem of, you know, lack of communication. You know, the whole book is kind of about Paul's inability to communicate with his dog he's trying to teach to talk, and also with the inability to communicate with the people we're closest to. You know, there's a question of how well did he know his wife Lexi. You know, to what degree did communication fail the two of them? But there's also in the title, in the story of Babel, there's kind of this element of hubris, of like trying to get above yourself in the natural order of things, which is very much what Paul is doing, you know, by trying to teach a dog to talk. He's kind of going into territory he might, maybe shouldn't go into. So that's my take on the title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's interesting. It's coming out in England under the title Lorelai's Secret. For some reason, no one they mentioned it to in England liked the title The Dogs of Babel. They all thought it sounded like a thriller or something like that. So it's just an interesting cultural thing. In some ways, the title is almost a marketing decision, but,
yeah,
you know.
Did you have any input over the British title?
My editor at the British publisher sent me a whole bunch of suggestions, and I said, okay, this one I like, this one I don't like. There was some talk about calling it The Mask Maker's Husband, but we ended up not liking that. So, you know, I'm happy with it. I prefer The Dogs of Babel, but I think Lorelai's Secret is fine.
Hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. Today I'm with Carolyn Parkhurst, the author of The Dogs of Babel, published by Little Brown. And I am still Barbara DeMarco Barrett. There's also something else that's in the beginning of this book, and that is that, you know, as the book goes on, we learn more and more about Lexi and some of her disturbances.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her ailments, disturbances, is trichotillomania.
Right.
I am so curious how you came up with that one.
it's an illness where people tear out their own hair, and it just, I think I once met someone who had this, and it just stuck in my head as, you know, I was looking for a way to talk about Lexi's adolescence, which was very troubled, and she went through a period of depression, and it just seemed to me that pulling out your own hair is kind of an unusual manifestation of internal anguish, and I was kind of interested in that, and the way it plays out in the book is that the first time Paul asks her to marry him, she says, "I'll marry you if you can tell me if I have any tattoos." And he says, "No." You know, of course, he thinks he knows her whole body. And she parts her hair for him, and there's a tattoo under her hair. And I just liked that idea of a picture being hidden somewhere on someone's body, you know, and it's not something we see every day. But so it all kind of worked together to create that.
Yeah, that was image. Interesting. I don't think I've seen that in a novel.
Yeah.
That's great. Reviews. So many of your reviews have been just, you know, stellar. How do you deal with reviews? Do you read them? How do they affect you?
It's hard. You know, I do read them. I know some writers don't, and perhaps later in my career I'll be able to reach that point, but I'm too curious at this point. I've gotten some great ones and I've gotten some bad ones, and it really was hard because for a long time the book was just my own, you know. It was just something I was working on kind of in private. I'm just this little person sitting in a house writing. And then you publish it, which is, you know, what my goal was, certainly, but suddenly it belongs to anyone who buys it. And, you know, it's just difficult to kind of, you know, hear people say things that aren't, you know, nice, but, you know, it's all just one person's opinion. And, you know, I certainly, there have been some pieces of criticism that I've thought, huh, that's valid. I can use that to make my next novel better, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any readers with this? Do you have a writer's group or people that you ran everything by say a man or men that could say, yeah, that's what a man would.
Yeah, well, my husband read it as I was writing it, and he was a very good critic. I also had one female friend who was a writer who read it as I was going along. I didn't have any formal group, but I would send out chapters to my friend and also to my mother, who was good if I was just kind of feeling down and needed someone to say, oh, this is the best thing I've ever read. You know? But, you know, I do find it's helpful to get feedback from somebody because, you know, you have no objectivity about your own work when you're working on it, and so, you know, it's good to bounce it off someone and get their feedback.
Sure. You've published short fiction prior to this novel. What for you is the difference between, I mean, other than the obvious, you know, length difference,
right.
But what's the difference for you between short stories and novels, and do you prefer one or the other?
You know, it's hard to say because I've only written one novel, you know, so I don't know how I'm going to feel in the future. For me, though, I think that in a way you can have more fun with it, not more fun with a short story, but you can do things you wouldn't want to do in a whole novel, like I'm currently working on a short story that has an incredibly nasty kind of narrator who's just a very bitter person, and she's a lot of fun to write about, but I wouldn't want to try to carry that off for a whole novel, you know? But the way you approach it is differently. I think in a short story, you're dealing with almost like one moment, like kind of an important moment in a person's life that changes everything. Whereas in a book, you can kind of follow the characters for more of a journey. You can kind of look at all the different aspects of their life and stuff, which is appealing too.
Interesting. Do you see yourself going back to short stories, or?
I see myself doing both. I kind of like working on a story and a novel at the same time because then, you know, every day when I sit down to write, I think, okay, I can choose. You know, do I feel like working on this or do I feel like working on that? And it's kind of a nice variety.
Mm-hmm. What about the names? The character's name, Lexi,
right,
and Lorelei seem to be very unusual names.
Right.
And I like them so much.
Yeah.
How did
you
come up with those names, and did you have them from the start?
You know, to some degree it was just kind of picking names I liked, but it was names that resonated for me in a certain way, and, you know, Lexi has its roots in words like lexicon, which have to do with words, and that's not really something I was kind of consciously thinking about when I chose the names, but, you know, it turned out to work very well with what I was trying to do, you know, with all the stuff about language. And,
Lorelei has a mythological root to it, which again was not something I was really thinking about when I picked it, but as I was writing the book, I did some research into it, and I thought that really fits somehow. You know, it's almost kind of luck that you choose the names you choose, and, you know, they work out or they don't.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if the Dogs of Babel began where it begins now. Was this always the beginning?
No, actually it wasn't. The first piece of the book I ever wrote was something I wrote in graduate school, which was a very short piece that was a false history of canine linguistics, where I made up these stories like the child dog of Lyon, where this woman in 16th century France raises a dog as if it's her child and tries to teach it to talk. And that was originally what came first in the book. And my writer friend, who was reading the book as I was writing it, said, you know, this is actually a very jarring way to begin a book. We don't know who the characters are. It's very academic sounding. And I ended up switching the first two chapters. The way the book reads now, chapter one and chapter two are reversed from where I started out. So it's a very good piece of advice, actually.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
We have another minute or so left. I wonder what you think about, the whole idea of, do you go with strengths or do you push and work with your weaknesses as a writer? What do you think? I mean, do you see yourself as having very specific strengths, and do you optimize those strengths?
Uh-huh.
Or do you just...
I suppose to some degree that I do, but I don't really think of it that way. I write about what I feel compelled to write about, and I do try to push myself. You know, sometimes I'll come up with an idea and I'll think that sounds too hard, you know, and then I'll say, no, you know, let's just see if I can do it. Let's just write it and see how it goes. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting. Carolyn, would you give some advice or words of wisdom to the writers listening who may be unpublished at this point are working their way toward publication?
Right. Well, the best advice, which is very simple, is just keep at it. You know, I have whole notebooks full of rejection letters that I've gotten from literary magazines and, you know, plus, you know, editors who didn't buy the book and stuff like that. You just have to, you know, trust that what you're doing is going to find a market eventually, and write what you want to write, not what you think other people are going to want to read. You know, write for yourself, not for a market, and just keep at it.
Yes. And you are going to be, let's see, at Romans in Pasadena?
Yes, that's right. I'll be doing a workshop on the Saturday morning workshop.
On the
19th?
I
don't have the date. I hope you do.
Yeah, the 19th. And what are you going to be doing in the workshop?
I'm going to be talking about finding inspiration in everyday life, just talking about the ways in which I came up with ideas for the book and how things that seem like very simple ideas kind of blossomed into, very interesting things once I started writing about them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I love your book. And,
well, thank you.
And I wish you continued success.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was Carolyn Parkhurst speaking to us from Washington, D.C. And again, she'll be at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena on Saturday, July 19th at 11 a.m. doing a workshop on finding inspiration in everyday life. And her book, The Dogs of Babel, is a wonderful read. If you have a busy week coming up, you might want to wait, because you'll end up putting off things that you intended to do so you could read this book. I know I did, and part of my problem is reading. I love to read. So anyway, I guess that goes without saying. Our next guest is Jen Pico. She'll be up in just a few minutes. We're going to take a quick break, and stay with us.
Oh, yeah. Y'all want to boogie? Thank you.
are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Welcome back to Writers on Writing.
And hello again. You are, as Debbie said, listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my next guest is Jodi Pico. She's author of Second Glance. She has a degree in creative writing from Princeton and a master's in education from Harvard. She is author of 9 previous books, including Perfect Match, Salem Falls, and Plain Truth. She lives in Georgia with her husband and 3 children. And as I said, her 10th book is Second Glance. Hi, Jodi.
How you doing, Barbara?
Good. How are you?
Great.
You're, 35? You have 3 kids, 10 novels?
Well, the truth is I'm 37. I've gotten a little older.
Well, okay then. 37, 3 kids, 10 novels now. And an MA in education from Harvard. Now, how do you do this? Do you do anything else?
I don't sleep. That's all. No. I work pretty hard, but I love what I do, and I think that does make a difference. And I've also been fortunate in the past couple of years to have a very accommodating husband who now carpools the kids all over the place so that I have limitless time to write, which is fantastic.
Well, gosh, I mean, you're so prolific. I'm just wondering, I mean, everything you just said makes sense in terms of being able to produce 10 novels, but I keep thinking there must be more. I mean, do the words just come flowing out of you, or are you very organized so that you have outlines and plots and you know where you're going so you use your time optimally, or?
Well, I actually think that for me, part of the reason that I write with such, I guess, discipline is because when I started writing 10 years ago, like you said, I basically had just had a baby when I started writing professionally. And I was living under this gross misconception that Kyle would sit at my feet and watch me, you know, while I wrote. And that was not happening. And I really learned by the time I had 3 of them, they're all 2 years apart. My oldest is going to be 12. And I realized very quickly that, you know, I had to write in the 10 minutes that they were napping, or when Barney was on TV, or when they weren't hitting each other over the head with a sippy cup, or, you know, at any spare moment that I could, I was in front of my computer and I was cranking something out. And because of that, I really didn't have the luxury of writer's block, and I do believe that's a luxury. I actually don't buy into it, because very little of writing, in my opinion, is waiting for the muse to hit you. Quite a lot of it is sitting there and just hammering it out. And there are some days that you write beautifully, and there are other days that you just know you're cranking out garbage.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always easier, in my opinion, to go back and edit garbage than to edit a blank page. And I think that level of discipline stayed with me to the point where years later, when I do have far more time to write, I still tend to work on that schedule.
Hmm. So you could sit down for, say, you know, you're putting on water for pasta, and your kids are in front of a video, and you could sit down for 10 minutes and do something.
Yeah. I did. Remember that movie, As Good as It Gets, with Jack Nicholson, where he gets interrupted by someone ringing the doorbell, and it ruins his whole line of thought?
Right.
If that was the way I functioned, I never would have gotten my first novel out, much less my 10th.
And
it's being able to pick up the thread quickly and get back into where you left off.
Mm-hmm.
And to get used to the fact that, you know, kids come up all the time into my office and are talking to me or telling me about their day or whatever, and I can go back and focus on what I was doing. And that, I guess, is a gift, because I don't think everybody is can do that as fluidly.
You know, I believe it, though. I think sometimes, especially women, it may be the only way you make any progress while your kids are little.
Exactly.
You know, unless you stick them somewhere and you go and write, which, you know, I don't want to do that.
Well, it would be great to have, you know, some kind of fantastic retreat that I could go to, or to go lock myself in Bali in a hut, but I don't have that choice. You know, and it works for me. And, you know, and actually I'm a better writer because I know that at the end of the day I do get to go downstairs and be with the family. And, you know, for me, this rhythm works very, very well.
Hmm.
But, you know, like I said, I don't think it's waiting for inspiration. I think if you sit around waiting for inspiration, you're going to be waiting a really long time.
Right.
Sometimes you have to go find the inspiration.
The muse is so very busy these days.
Pardon?
I said, the muse is so very busy
exactly,
these days, waiting,
yeah.
waiting for her to visit. May,
exactly.
You may
yeah.
be sitting there.
And I'm not, I mean, I'd like to say I was incredibly organized, but I would be so lying to you. I do tend to know where I think my plots are going. I'm often wrong. About two-thirds of the way, the characters sort of get up and take it where they need to go, and I've tried to force them back, and I've learned it's not a very good idea. It feels much more organic when they go where they need to go, and often the things they do surprise me, but they're the right things.
Hmm.
If I have a big twist at the end of my books, like I do in many of them, I carefully lay that out, that thread out, because I want you to be able to go back and see what you've missed.
Mm-hmm.
But there will still be, the way that you get to that end point will usually be very different from what I imagined.
So how much do you know? For instance, with Second Glance, your mm-hmm. most recent book, how much did you know going into it, writing it? Did you know where you were headed? Did you know what the major plot points were?
Mm-hmm. I started that book, I came about that book almost by accident. I came about it saying one day I woke up and said, I want to write a ghost story. And I didn't really know why, but I hadn't done one of those yet, and I thought it would be interesting. And so I started with that tack, and I said, well, I clearly need a ghost, and started reading a newspaper article from the Burlington Free Press up in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to mention how a group of local Abenaki Indians were protesting the development of a piece of land because they said it was a burial ground. And quite honestly, where I live up in New Hampshire, we get this kind of news three or four times a year. It's not really news. But I thought, gee, you know, Indian burial ground, excellent place for a ghost. And I went up to my computer and I plugged the word Abenaki into a search engine. And I got a lot of hits about the Abenaki tribe, but one small article linked to the Boston Globe, and I read this interview with a woman who had written her doctoral thesis at the University of Vermont about the Vermont Eugenics Project in the 1920s and 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what that was, so I kind of kept reading. And it turns out that back in the 20s and 30s, a bunch of very bright people, like professors at the University of Vermont and Calvin Coolidge and Margaret Sanger, they were all proponents of a scientific program to shore up the gene pool in Vermont, to keep it the kind of tourist attraction that they wanted it to be by getting rid of people who they didn't think belonged there, who were economic and social drains. And those were pretty much anyone who wasn't a white Protestant Yankee. So they went around and they targeted degenerate families in prisons and poorhouses and mental institutions. And over the course of about 15 years, hundreds of Abenaki Indians and French Canadian Catholics were sterilized so that they wouldn't reproduce anymore. And I was reading this going, wow, I didn't know this, and I couldn't believe I didn't know this. And then I found out that the reason that the program died was because funding dried up when people found out that Hitler had been watching these programs very carefully and credited the 33 states in America with a law like this on the books that basically led him to his plan for racial hygiene. And I mean, you know, this is a really nasty little secret that we don't know in America.
Right.
And I really couldn't believe that we didn't know it. And I understood very quickly that if I was writing a book about the things that come back to haunt you, this was the perfect historical complement. So I began to twist a plot around these two threads, a ghost story that somehow would take us back to the eugenics project in Vermont. And I wound up creating a story about a man named Ross Wakeman, whose fiance dies in a car accident 8 years earlier, and all he wants to do is be with her. And he starts by trying to kill himself, but he's actually quite bad at it and keeps surviving, and then turns to the field of paranormal investigation. And he is trying to find a ghost, but, you know, he can't. And eventually he winds up chucking it all in and going to live with his sister Shelby in the small town of Vermont. And just as he gets there, some very strange things begin happening in the town. They develop a piece of land, and as soon as they do, the Abenaki start complaining, and then rose petals begin to fall out of the sky, and the ground freezes solid, and cats all walk down to the river to bathe at the same time every day. And eventually one of the developers calls Ross in and says, hey, could you just kind of take a look at this on the fly for me? And what he finds is a 70-year-old unsolved murder that takes us right back to the eugenics program in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
So the middle section of the book is told from the point of view of my ghost.
Ah, interesting.
And so it's a very convoluted book, and it kind of felt like doing brain surgery when I was writing it, because there were so many different threads to sew together. But I knew that I was going to be flashing back, and then I knew I was going to flash forward and tie together all the loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of surprises in this book, a lot of things that come out at the end that, you know, it's one after another. So in a way, it was sort of like the mother of all books to write.
Yeah, interesting. Now, you have so many different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
Will you talk about that in terms of why you did choose different points of view to write the book?
Yeah, I actually love point of view. When I teach writing workshops,
mm-hmm.
I tend to teach about point of view because I think it's one of the great overlooked pieces of teaching writing. You know, we always hear about the third person objective point of view, and then we always hear about the first person point of view. But there's also, you know, that third person subjective where you can kind of swoop in and out of characters' heads,
mm-hmm.
and I find that really fascinating. And what's to me even more interesting is trying to figure out which point of view you need to tell your story. Because, for example, if you happen to use a first-person narrator and they don't happen to be in the critical scene of your book, well, you know, you're out of luck because there's nobody to tell you what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when you write a mystery, you really need to think that through, I think, before you get to the end, or you're going to find yourself with 300 pages that have all been a waste.
Right.
You know, in this particular book, because I was playing around so much with time, and with not only with time but also with different threads of theme, I didn't want to complicate things by having multiple first-person narrators, but I also knew that I was going to want to hear from several different people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I chose a third-person subjective, which to me means that every time I do a section break, I can be in someone else's head.
Yes.
And I think it's not hard to read. I think it's easy for a reader to follow. It allows you to get closer to your reader than a third-person objective point of view. But when I got to that middle section, and I was back in the 1930s, I wanted it first-person. I wanted you to hear my ghost speaking, and I wanted her to be talking to you. And so when you read that section, it's I did this and I did that, and I think it brings the reader much closer to what's going on and in a way almost implicates them in what's happening.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that, such a practical reason why it's also easy to follow, you know, switching points of view, is your names are all so different. I don't know mm-hmm. if that's even on purpose, but your names of characters, it's never like, wait a minute, Ross, they're all just different.
Yeah, it is an interesting choice because you are setting the reader up, I think, for a challenge whenever you pick a certain point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I think the traditional way to write, if you're a beginning writer, is in a third-person point of view, you know, where you're God and you're looking down at all your little figurines and moving them around, because it's easiest. It is extremely challenging to write multiple first-person points of view. In my opinion, that's the hardest because not only are you switching, but you got to make them all sound different. Because if you don't, then your reader's going to get confused even if they know that it's a different person talking every time they pick up a new chapter. So that's quite hard. And, in fact, I have a friend who is an author, Chris Bojalian, who's a wonderful writer.
Oh, yes.
He wrote a book called Buffalo
Weeks
Soldier.
Back.
And I was at one of his events, and someone asked him why he chose to write it in that particular point of view. And he does third-person subjective, much like Second Glance.
Yes.
And what he said was, well, because there were too many people's stories that I needed to hear, and so I couldn't pick one first-person point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him later on, I said, well, yeah, but what about multiple first-person points of view? And he said, oh, God, I didn't feel like doing that either. Because it would have been much harder.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, this book came out beautifully.
Yes.
But there's also first-person, I think, is as close as you can get to a character. When you take it back to a third-person subjective, it's a little bit more removed. It's almost like you're looking through a smoky window. You can see them pretty well, but there's still a plate of glass between you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you move to third-person objective, like I said, you're up in the sky and you're looking down on what's happening.
Yes. Will you read to us?
I would love to read to you.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. Today I am talking with Jodi Picco, author of Second Glance, and she's going to read.
I am going to read. I'm actually going to read from pretty much close to the beginning of the book, and I just told you a little bit about Ross Wakeman, who is my main character in this book. And when we first meet him, he's actually still working for a paranormal investigator who has a show on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to read to you a little bit about Ross's foray into paranormal investigation.
Okay.
In person, Curtis Warburton was smaller than he seemed to be on television, but he lacked none of the magnetism that had made Boogeyman Nights the second highest rated show in its time slot. His black hair was shot skunk-like with a white streak, one he'd possessed since a night 9 years before when the ghost of his grandfather had appeared at the foot of his bed and led him into the field of paranormal investigation. His wife, Maylene, an elf of a woman whose psychic abilities were well known to the Los Angeles police, perched beside him, taking notes as Curtis posed questions to the owners of the house. "First was the kitchen," murmured Eve O'Donnell, and her husband nodded. A retired couple, they'd bought this home on the lake as a summer retreat, and in their 3 months of tenancy had experienced supernatural phenomena at least twice a week. "About 10 in the morning, I locked up all the doors, put on the alarm system, and went to the post office. When I came home, the alarm was still on, but inside the kitchen cabinets were open, and every cereal box was on the table, spilled on its side. I called Harlan, thinking he'd come home and left a mess." "I was at the Elks Club the whole time," her husband interjected. And there's the calliope music we heard coming from the attic at 2 a.m. Minute we went upstairs, it stopped. Opened the door to find a child's toy piano missing its battery sitting in the middle of the floor." "We don't own a toy piano," Harlan added, "much less a child." Eve hesitated. "Mr. Warburton, I hope you understand that we're not the kind of people who believe in this sort of thing. It's just that if it's not this, I'm losing my mind." "Mrs. O'Donnell, you're not going crazy." Curtis touched her hand with trademark sympathy. "By tomorrow morning, we'll have a better idea what's going on in your home." He looked over his shoulder to make sure Ross was getting this on camera. Depending on what happened later, the O'Donnells might find themselves featured on Boogeyman Nights, and if so, this footage was critical. The Warburtons received over 300 emails a day from people who believed their houses were haunted. 85% of the claims turned out to be hoaxes or mice in the rafters. The rest, well, Ross had been working with them long enough to know that there were some things that simply couldn't be explained. "Have you experienced any spectral visions?" Curtis asked. "Temperature changes?" "Our bedroom will be hot as hell 1 minute, and then we'll be shivering the next," Harlan answered. "Are there any spots in the house where you feel uncomfortable?" The attic, definitely. "The upstairs bathroom." Curtis's eyes swept from the hand-knotted oriental rug to the antique vase on the mantel of the fireplace. "I have to warn you that finding a ghost can be a costly proposition." As the Warburton's field researcher, Ross had been sent to libraries and newspaper archives to locate documents about the property and hopefully the bonus information that a murder or suicide might have occurred there. His inquiry had turned up nothing, but that never stopped Curtis. After all, a ghost could haunt a person as well as a place. History could hover like a faint perfume or a memory stamped on the backs of one's eyelids. "Whatever it takes," Eve O'Donnell said, "this isn't about money." "Of course not." Curtis smiled and slapped his palms on his knees. "Well then, we've got some work to do." That was Ross's cue. "I thought I'd check the attic," Ross said. He stood in the doorway for a moment, waiting for Eve O'Donnell to lead the way upstairs. "I feel foolish," she confided. "At my age, seeing Casper?" Ross smiled. "A ghost can shake you up a little and make you think you're nuts, but it's not going to hurt you." "Oh, I don't think she hurt me." "She?" Eve hesitated. "Harlan said I shouldn't volunteer any information. That way, if you see what we do, we'd know." She shivered, glanced up the narrow stairs. "My little sister died when I was 7. Sometimes I wonder, can a ghost find you if she wants to?" Ross looked away. "I don't know," he said. His eyes lit on the small door at the top of the stairs. "Is that it?" She nodded, letting him pass in front of her to unlatch it. The video camera Ross had mounted outside watched them from the window, a cyclops. Eve hugged herself tightly. "Being here gives me the chills." Ross moved some boxes so that no shadows would be caught on tape that could be explained away. "Curtis says that's how you know where to find them. You go with what your senses are telling you." A wink on the floor caught his eyes. Kneeling, he picked up a handful of pennies. 6 cents, he smiled. "Ironic. She does that sometimes." Eve was edging toward the door, her arms wrapped around herself. "Leaves us change." "The ghost?" Ross asked, turning, but Eve had already fled down the stairs. Taking a deep breath, he closed the door to the attic and shut the light, plunging the small room into blackness. He fixed his attention on the darkness around him, letting it press in at his chest and the backs of his knees until the lip of disbelief thinned, until the space around him bloomed. "Maybe this is it," he thought. "Maybe the coming of ghosts feels like a sob at the back of your throat." Somewhere off to the left with the sound of a footfall and the unmistakable chime of coins striking the floor. Switching on a flashlight, Ross swung the beam until it illuminated his boot and three new pennies beside it. Amy, he whispered to the empty ear air, is that you?
Thank you.
Sure.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. That was Jodi Picco reading from Second Glance. You know, there's so much in this book that, I mean, there's just, it is complicated.
It's very complicated. It's really hard to pick a reading, too.
Well, you know, I am curious that how you are able to so wonderfully write about difficult things like loss, like I think Shelby's son can't go out in daylight because he has a skin disease that will shorten his life if he gets any UV rays.
Mm-hmm.
How do you write about difficulties without just, you know, letting it affect your own life, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
It's an interesting question. I think part of it is because I have a great life. I mean, you know, I guess everybody says that every now and then, but I really do. I live in a beautiful place. I have a great husband. I have three terrific kids. My parents are still together. I even like my brother. I mean, you know, everything's good. And at first I thought that was a real detriment to being a writer because I thought, you know, well, where's the incest in my family? Where's the rape? I need something to write about.
Uh-huh.
And it took me a long time to understand that I didn't need to write about what I knew, which is, of course, what you're told the first time you take any kind of writing class, right,
yeah.
What you know. If I wrote what I knew, nobody would ever want to read it because it's incredibly boring. But to write what I wanted to know. And, you know, part of the reason my books really go all over the map is because they take me to research areas that I just find fascinating. And if I can find it fascinating, I can make you find it fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think I can go to such dark places is because I get to leave at the end of the day. And I get to go downstairs, and my kids are telling, you know, stupid kid jokes, and everything's great. And I don't think if that cushion wasn't there for me, if I had to leave this office and be mired in the kind of emotions that my characters are, I think I'd have a much harder time. People are usually pretty surprised when they meet me, because I tend to be very upbeat and happy, and
mm-hmm.
I sure don't write that.
Right.
Every time I give my poor mother a new manuscript, she reads it and goes, oh, another uplifting Jodi Picco book. you know, and maybe one day I'll write a great laugh fest, but it hasn't happened to me yet.
That's interesting.
What I tend to think is that, I mean, for example, you know, I am not suicidal, and I never have been suicidal. Ross is. And you can write that with great poignance, even if you haven't gotten to that low, because I really believe that all human emotion is just on a sliding scale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe you've never held a knife over your wrist, but you've probably had a really awful day where you just didn't think you measured up and where you didn't believe there was any way you were going to ever fit into this world.
Yeah.
And if you can channel that emotion and just amplify it a little, expand it a little, you can pretty much nail the emotion that you want for Ross. And, you know, the same goes with, for example, Perfect Match, which was my book last year and was about a mother who basically takes revenge into her own hands after her son is sexually abused. Now, thank God that's never happened to any of my children, but I can sure tell you what it feels like when the bully starts picking on your kid and, you know, you don't care if the bully's 6 years old, you want to go and deck him. And, you know, any kind of basic human feeling like that is
sure.
The starting point for writing something darker or more passionate or, you know, deeper in some way. You know, everyone's had their heart broken. Everyone has experienced a great love in their life that got away. Everyone has felt great love for another human or a child or a pet or something. And if you can hook the reader just with that one little loop, you can usually pull them in, even if they, like you, haven't been quite to where the character's been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great stuff. Because
well, and it's hard. You know, like, I mean, I wrote The Pact, which is about teen suicide, and happens to be, for many of my books, many people like it the most. And actually, Second Glance, too, I never considered a happy book. And but, you know, I wasn't depressed writing Second Glance, because I felt, actually, as a book, I think it's a very redemptive book. The Pact really depressed me, because there was nobody in that book that was happy. It's about teen suicide and its impact on two families. And I was very, very ready to let go of those characters by the time I finished it, just because, like you said, it does start to grate on you when you spend, you know, 8 hours a day with people who are speaking and crying and wailing and moaning because they really have experienced the worst that you could ever experience.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, you know, the people that you share your head with. So it sometimes does get a little close for comfort.
Yeah. Gosh, we have like another 2 minutes left. You should have come on for an hour, but you write so much that you can come on soon again with your next book. Real quick, I'm curious if you have readers. Do you have a writer's group? I mean, do you run your work by anybody before your editor sees it?
I do. I actually have several people who read my work in progress in the Stephen King installment version. My agent reads it. My mother reads it. A friend of mine who is a novelist reads it. And a friend of mine who is a screenwriter reads it. And the four of them give me very, very different feedback that mm-hmm. I somehow, you know, cull together and use to do my next several series of drafts. By the time my editor sees it, it's usually in pretty good shape.
Any last words, Jody, for the writers listening?
I guess what I would say is that the longer I'm in this and the more I get asked about, well, how, you know, did you get rejections and how do you make it through, I really do believe that in some ways it's a baptism by fire, and all of the no's that you're going to get are trying to weed out the people who don't belong in the business. And if eventually you stick with it and you keep believing you've got something and you hone your craft and you put aside the rejections and keep writing because it's what you love to do, someone will take a second look and wonder why you're so sure of yourself. And sometimes that's really all you need, that second look.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if there's any hope I can offer, it's that it does happen.
Hmm. Thank you so
well, thank
much.
Thank you, Barbara.
For coming on and being so wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And do come back with your next book.
I would love to. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care.
That was Jody Pico speaking with us from New Hampshire. And her website is jodipico.com. That's JODIPICOULT.com. If you have any questions or comments or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, do visit my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can sign up to be on the mailing list. And every week I send out messages as to who's coming on. Thank you once again, Debbie Keith, for so generously engineering the show.
My pleasure.
It's you're just a wonderful person and writer and PA host and so many things.
Thank you.
I'd like to leave you with a quote by Polly Marshall, who said, "Words were living things to her. She senses them bestriding the air and charging the room with strong colors." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening.